Hello and welcome to Upvote, a tech and politics podcast from Wired UK. I'm Ronan Mapthorpe, and today we're going to be discussing the strange anniversary that is the year of Donald Trump's presidency with two people who've peered into, I'm going to say, the darker side of Trump's America. Emily Gorsensky, a data scientist based in Charlottesville, Virginia. We'll talk more about that place later. And Matt Mitchell, who founded the monthly New York crypto party, Crypto Harlem, amongst other things. Thank you both for coming on the show.
Thank you for having us.
So, maybe a good way to think about this is think about what you were doing a year ago. Because I guess what I'm really getting at is how life's changed since then. So, yeah, a year ago, what were you doing?
A year ago, I just started this fellowship with Mozilla and Ford Foundation. It had me working with a civil rights group called Color of Change, based in New York. And, you know, I was actually here in the UK at this Mozilla Festival thing. And, you know, I work with Movement for Black Lives, doing digital safety for them. I train activists and journalists in digital security. And there are a lot of apprehension and anxiety about this upcoming election, but also a lot of excitement and anticipation.
And then when Trump got elected, I think it was 7 days later, what did you think?
It was a dark day. It was a dark day, and a lot of people were sad and depressed and didn't know what to do. And everyone, suddenly, people who I told them, install Signal, use this digital safety security, you know, apparatus and tools and things, right? They suddenly were like flooding my inbox. We need to meet, you know, we need to do something. And a lot of people who organized things like protesting the inauguration are now being hunted down by the Department of Justice.
I was going to say, a year on, how has life changed? I mean, that must be, is that one big change then?
Yeah, one big change is, you know, for, I think like, for LGBTQ, gender nonconforming folks, for black and brown folks, the United States has always been a place where you're seen as a suspicious other. But I think like the general populace, the like dominant, you know, mainstream group of people, right? They're just like, wait, now we feel it. Now we feel like this is a place where we're not comfortable. This is a place that rejects us. This is a place where we're seen as suspicious and other. And I'm, you know, I'm ill armed to defend myself. What can I do as a citizen? So I felt that, wow, now I see all these people identifying with these issues and all these people need help. I know like apps like Signal had like 400 times the amount of people install it overnight, you know, things like this. And unfortunately, what we see today is our fears are justified. Activists, people standing up for their rights, people trying to defend themselves and liberate their people are being hunted down and attacked.
Emily, what about you? What were you doing a year ago?
Yeah, that's interesting. A year ago, I had just started a new job, and I left a space where I had worked actually as a defense contractor for about 8 years. And
what's a defense contractor? Does that mean you were working for the military?
I would work on contracts, research contracts for the military, for NASA, for the National Institutes of Health, various technologies, generally around reliability engineering for physical devices, aircraft safety, making engines more fuel efficient. I wasn't designing weapons per se, but I was definitely complicit in this military complex and took a lot of money from that in a small business research environment.
And you just started a new job then?
And I had, you know, over the past couple of years, my politics had really started to change, and I decided to get out of that industry. I didn't really want to be doing that work anymore. And I wanted to do something that helped people more directly. So I had started this new job, and I was very hopeful and very looking forward to a very calm future where I could build technologies to help people manage their money and understand money, using my data science background to do that. And then the election chain happened and everything sort of changed. And I realized that I had all of this knowledge and all of this skill built up from spending the previous 8 years working professionally in the defense industry, but prior to that also being a student in engineering spaces, working for the government, for the Department of Energy, and really understanding how government processes work. So I kind of knew what was going to be coming and what to look out for. And so my first inclination, literally the night of the election, was the first thing I could think of is I need to start spreading information for how people can survive, how people can get to places of safety, especially queer folks. And I think as I was watching the election results come in, I just started a thread on protest safety, on how to navigate urban environments without maps, without phones, just skills that we have sort of lost in our modern era, and turn that into, oh no, now I need to actually become an activist and, you know, not just talk, but actually do and act and actively resist what was coming.
So you're a full-time activist now?
I am not a full-time activist now, although it feels like that. I actually, I would say that activism is my second full-time job at this point. I do not get paid for it. There are no checks coming from George Soros. But it has become, based on where I live, something out of necessity right now.
And I really do want to talk about Charlottesville. But yes. First, I'm super curious. What's your life like now, a year on? Like, when you look back at a year ago, how have things changed? I can see you're sighing like, man, this has been a big change.
Yeah, it has been an enormous change. I don't even know how to contextualize it. Everything has really changed. Certainly the events in my hometown have forced a lot of change, but I think that there's sort of a greater thing happening, and being in technology and being an outspoken queer person in tech, there has been, over the past several years, a bit of a battle going on with certain personalities, and, you know, Gamergate being a major event in the tech space. And so right after the election, when we found out that people like Steve Bannon were coming into significant power, it was actually quite worrisome, because these are people that, if you were in tech and if you were fighting some of these movements of white supremacy within the tech industry, as I had been, you knew that this was a problem, because we'd been fighting these people for quite some time and they all have us on a list. And so my first reaction, like after the dust had settled on the election and we realized, oh no, this is actually happening. My first reaction was, well, I have to get out of the country because I'm on a list being managed by, you know, somebody who now has direct access to the president. And that's quite a terrifying thing to be in.
And a lot of what you do, what both of you do, is about educating people, in particular about online safety. So, and Matt, you host these crypto parties,
yeah,
right? So tell me about a crypto party. What happens at one of those?
Sure. Well, you know, it's where you can take your questions and get answers from someone. It's where people together can learn about circumvention technologies, things that you can use to avoid surveillance, to avoid tracking, and also learn how these things come into play, what they look like, how they work, what are the capabilities and methods of different adversaries for different groups, right? So, you know, when I have my crypto party, Crypto Harlem, we come together, we do the current events, how does the news affect you where you are? And we all just learn together. I'm just more like a facilitator to make sure it's a 3-hour event. Hop in, hop out. You can leave anytime. Just make sure that, you know, we're moving on schedule, you know?
And so, does it work?
You know what? It does work. You know, people who need assistance will show up, because people really feel like they want to find the solutions to the problems that face them and their communities. They need some like specific answers. How do I encrypt an email? How do I secure my laptop? Is it true that this can happen and that can happen? And, you know, I can explain, like, that's a myth. This is the right way to do it. These are the steps. And I see those people return and come back, develop their skills, and become like actually really great at taking this information, not just using it for themselves, but disseminating it to the people they care about, to the communities they come from.
And you've been running this for quite a little while, I think. And I think you were inspired by the death of Trayvon Martin. Is that right?
That is correct. You know, I was working at the New York Times at the time as a data journalist, using my like coding skills to make tools to help journalists do what they do faster. You know, all kinds of cool things. So one reporter, it has the power of like 10. But when Trayvon Martin was killed, and after the George Zimmerman hearing, I felt really like gutted. You know, I felt really low. And at work, it was just another news day. And I felt, what am I doing with my skills to really help the community? And that's when I took Crypto Harlem and my work in training activists from being like a nights and weekends, you know, hobby to my full-time, what I do and my commitment for my life.
And then looking back at that period, does it feel like things are really getting worse, or that in some ways, are you heartened by the fact that people are coming to you and looking for education and is this in some sense a wake-up call?
You know, I tell people, like, who actually checks the fire extinguisher, knows its location, the smoke detector, knows the battery's charged, someone who survived a fire. Who has, like, security in their home? Someone who came home and their house was robbed and things were thrown all over the place, right? That feeling of low and violation, right? I think this presidency is like a wake-up call. You have to be on a side. No matter who you are, you have to act, and you become an activist. And I think from that, only good can come. From that a moment we can be safer together and really plan a better foundation for how we're going to move forward.
So, and Emily, you've written quite a lot about this sort of thing, especially in relation to Charlottesville. And so you were there when there was this far-right rally. Yes. Tell me a bit about that and what happened.
That was, there's a lot about that. Just as sort of a little bit of background, what we saw was the largest gathering of white nationalists in the United States in at least 30 years, if not longer. And this rally, we had known it was coming for a couple of months, and we had been doing everything we could to sound the alarm that this was not just politics as normal, that this was not about free speech, that this was an attempt to create something evil, and that there was a very strong likelihood of violence to come out of this. And what we saw, the first thing that happened was the night of August 11th, which most people weren't aware of and still are not, where many of the rallygoers, and when I say actual Nazis, I'm not being facetious. These were people who were wearing swastikas. They were, marching and chanting Nazi slogans as they were marching through the University of Virginia campus. And they were carrying torches. And the first thing that they did was they had this march up to the statue of Thomas Jefferson on the University of Virginia campus. And I had followed that march the whole way, and they encircled a small group of students who had gone there to counter-protest, and they actually attacked us with those torches, with mace, with fuel, with fire. And it was stunning that that could happen and that the rally could still go on the next day. And what we saw was not a political rally. There was nothing to do with speech. That was really just open street combat. People came with shields and bats and clubs and guns. And something that people who aren't in America or don't spend a lot of time in America don't really appreciate is how ingrained gun culture is, especially in the South. And so we saw heavily armed militia members who were private citizens marching with long guns and heavy assault rifles. And so what we had was a very dynamic situation where law enforcement actually just stepped back and said, we're going to let you fight it out in the streets. And when the event finally got shut down because they were throwing incendiary devices at us, chaos happened. And then, of course, there was the now famous vehicle attack where somebody drove his car probably about 50 miles an hour into a group of peaceful protesters who were marching on a closed street. And one person died. So this was sort of the culmination of this year of buildup. And we knew it was coming. And it seemed like nothing could stop this from happening. And so now the question is, what do we do now that we've seen that this is happening, that these are not simply conservative-minded people, but actually people who want to forcibly create an ethno-state. And they have the support of the President of the United States in doing so.
And what's the answer to that question?
I think, as Matt was saying, the answer to that is to really boost our sense of community and build up tools for community defense. Crypto parties is one avenue. Building out capability for mutual aid, for being able to support people to reduce the reliance on the state. We are telling people, do not call the police. If you are having a situation, call somebody trusted. Call somebody that has de-escalation skills. Call somebody that can show up and manage a situation and help you. Do not call the police and escalate these situations, because you put everybody in danger when you do that. And that is borne out by the statistics where we see hundreds of people largely black and brown people in the United States have been shot by police this year. So we're really trying to boost a sense of community defense as our central form of resistance and praxis.
Matt, you're nodding.
Yeah, I agree. You know, we go to people who work for the state only when, you know, the community breaks down. You know, there was a time when we lived in villages and, you know, if there was a fire, your neighbor would have a bucket of water and just run over and take it out, right? But as we moved away from this close-knit community, then we needed to have people who would do this. The state would pay them with our money. But now, by being taxed, the state is taking our money and killing us. So why not just go back to community, have no police zones, have people who have a vested interest that begins with love and care for you, helping you do good. And I think, like, you know, it could be depressing looking at the way things are right now. But I think a seed is planted that's going to be a beautiful tree where you'll know your neighbor, you'll support each other, like-minded people will win because we have a vested interest in care and love and just being free.
Because that makes it sound like this is the beginning of something really quite different. I mean, Emily, because you had a blog post I thought was really interesting asking the question, what is victory?
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose in some sense, people might think that victory is just going back to calm, right? But it sounds like you're talking about, I mean, really moving away from the state as we know it.
Yeah, and I think that what we've seen with the Trump presidency in the U.S. is just how fragile our systems of governance are. You know, we have this structure in the United States, this electoral college, which is designed specifically for this instance where somebody is elected president who is unqualified and possibly through nefarious means, and it didn't do anything. We have this multiple ways to remove a president when he is not doing his job. None of those systems are working right now. And so what we've seen is that we can no longer trust our governmental systems to protect us. The government doesn't keep us safe. The state doesn't keep us safe. We keep us safe. And I'm seeing this as in communities all across the country and across the world where this is really starting to gel and take hold, that this idea of, no, we actually have to get back to community involvement. And first we need to build up our own communities and take care of each other. I'm seeing this repeated all throughout the country. And I think that there is something changing, that there's a big pivot happening in reaction to this. And I think everyone is coming at this in parallel and kind of coming to the same conclusion.
But I wanted to ask about the role of technology in all this. Because mm-hmm. technology plays into this debate in this kind of weird way. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it feels like it's accelerating it. And sometimes it feels like it's kind of working against everyone's best efforts to try and make things more normal. I mean, like, Matt, how do you reflect on the role of that technology plays in this debate?
Sure. Well, you know, we all know technology is like a double-edged sword. You could use, like, for example, nuclear power to fuel a city for pennies. We also could use nuclear power to turn a city into ashes. So let's take two things. Let's take the March on Washington, civil rights movement, Martin Luther King. And let's take people protesting the inauguration of Donald Trump. In the March on Washington, people handed out flyers. We're going to do this thing. We're going to organize all these community groups. We're going to march and talk. People galvanized. They walked. They stood there in protest. There were speeches. And then they went home. Let's look at the inauguration of Donald Trump. There were websites saying, hey, do you feel this way? There were Facebook groups. Let's get together, everyone. Let's do this. Social media and Twitter. People showed up. There was some violence, you know. There are people who are really outraged and upset. And now we find the Department of Justice can access Facebook groups. Everyone who liked this Facebook group, we would like to know what their user IDs are on Facebook. Everyone who visited the website, we want to know their IP addresses to know where their homes are, right? This is real. Because of pushing back that came from Twitter, pushing back that came from the web host of a lot of these sites like Disrupt J20, right? The Department of Justice moved back and said, okay, not everyone, but definitely the people who were like the leaders or who worked there, people who were there, right? We have closed circuit television, which is a lot like the CCTV here in London, but it's smarter. It does facial recognition. One in every two Americans, their face is in a a national like FBI database. So you're matched against, you know, taking from DMV records to seed the database, right? So now you have people fighting for their rights, taking a movement that could be easily quashed and silenced. And there are people who are afraid. There's a real chilling effect when you see these things. It's very public. You know, I'm working with people who are saying, like, I just got this email that says, like, I could be pulled into this Department of Justice investigation just because I saw something and I cared. And, you know, it's not a human being looking at emails and looking at your posts and tweets. It's like companies like Geofedia and Dataminer who are looking for sentiment analysis. This person started this hashtag. This it seemed 80% angry, 10%, you know, dangerous, you know. And that's what we're dealing with today. So basic movements can be stopped before they begin.
Because it sometimes feels like the debate amongst people on this side has gone in two directions. And there's one which is let's try and take control of the platforms. Mm-hmm. And then there's the other, which is the platforms are never going to be helpful. Let's say re-decentralize and try and get away from the platforms. I mean, how do you feel about those two strands?
Well, let's take a look at Facebook. A lot of people use Facebook. I'm even on there. We could use anything safer, right? So why not? Facebook, if you're an intern at Facebook, you make $7,000 US a month. If you're a new hire as an engineer, you make $126,000 a year, right? The bills for the servers are in the 30 million, you know, 24 hours a day, always running these servers, right? That's one server farm, you know, 20, 30 million a year. All of this, and they're still profitable, still making money. Never in the red. How much do you pay for Facebook? How much I pay? Zero. Facebook is a master of taking our data, like coal, and crushing it and turning it into diamonds. Why would they have any incentive to serve the people when they're actually using the people? They're giving you a bad deal on your land so they can dig and dig and find oil and not give you anything? I do not trust that partner. So we cannot look for solutions from these large organizations like tech companies and giants. It has to come from the people because we care about each other.
But as I'm sure you'll know, it's become so impossible to do anything without Facebook because they basically have this hold on social life, on community organizing of any kind. I mean, I'm not on Facebook and I have been invited to a party for about 5 years.
I'm so sorry about
that. And I think that is the reason, life, by the way. Yeah.
Yeah, well, let me tell you. In my neighborhood, I started Crypto Harlem and we had like Meetup and Facebook and we were like inviting people on Twitter and not that many people showed up. It was only when I spent 3 hours for each one, flyers, talking to people. Hey, sis, you want to go to this? Hey, brother on the corner, you want to go to this thing? Talking to imams, talking to clerics, talking to priests, right? Going to the churches, going to the mosque, and pounding the pavement. That's something that's real. You make eye contact, you have this thing in your hand, you're like, this is ridiculous. Don't you know about the internet? But that's when the doors flew open and people started showing up in my neighborhood. You don't Google where the new barbershop is. You know, you don't go on Twitter to find that hot club. You know, you need to talk to people. You know, you have to do that. You have to make that headway. And that real human reaction that I challenge anyone to have to not amplify the work that they're doing. It's we are tricked into thinking there is no other way. But before the day that they launched, you still did this. You still organized. We still made change happen.
Emily, you're nodding. Because that's quite weird in a way to be hearing that message is the internet isn't maybe as important as we thought, or at least social networks aren't as important as we thought.
Yeah, I think that we're starting to realize that we're not really getting the value out of them as people that we once were. And just as a little bit of a personal story, very recently, since the events in Charlottesville, I had been, my Facebook profile is very closed off to only people that I know personally, have grown up with, know in my day-to-day life. And I had been putting out all of these calls for help and assistance and saying, this is what happened. This is what I'm going through. I am begging you for help. And I literally said, I am begging you for help. And I began to realize that the only people that were responding, the only people that were doing anything, were also people in the movement who were already saturated with their own issues, saying, well, I can come over and make dinner for you tonight, or I can contribute $50 towards a security fund, or whatever. And it wasn't the people that I had gone to high school with or gone to college with. And I eventually just cut those people out of my life. You know, if you can't, like, this was international news. And if you can't pick up the phone and call me and say, hey, how are you doing? Are you coping all right? you know, why am I even having you in my life? And so I actually excluded a bunch of people from Facebook as I did this, and sort of realized later, like, they might not even have any idea, because Facebook is so algorithmic that they might not even be seeing these pleas for help. And when I realized, like, oh, wait, I'm only using it for the to communicate with people in the movement, what am I even doing? What is the point? I'm already talking with these folks. So, you know, why don't we just go back to that community, that sense of, like, every week we meet for community defense planning or whatever it might be. So I definitely think that there's, you know, that the social networking was created in an era to make it more convenient for us to communicate with people in our lives, but has evolved to a point where we're no longer using it for that. It's no longer empowering that. So at that point, what's the point?
So we've got potentially 3 more years of Trump or another member of his administration, a quarter of the way through.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you feel like the next 3 years are going to play out? What's going to happen next?
I think there's some really dark stuff coming, to be completely honest. And we're seeing the J20 defendants, the people that were arrested for protesting the inauguration, some 200 people are facing up to 70 years in prison each for conspiracy charges for a riot because a couple of windows were broken by a couple of people on one particular block. And so the vast majority of these people just happened to be there in the wrong place at the wrong time, and they're now facing the rest of their lives in prison. Whereas James Fields, the person who ran us down on 4th Street in Charlottesville, is only facing second-degree murder charges and may not spend nearly that much time in prison. As a organizer of the counter-protests, I was completely nonviolent throughout the day. I preached nonviolence because of the scale of this, and I have to now worry about federal investigations myself and political grand juries against myself, which is not a very pleasant place to be in. And this is, so we're really seeing the next few years of expected state repression of people who are organizing, people who are planning, people who are trying to resist the state in a totally legal, nonviolent way, even, that we're expecting the state to come down very, very hard on us. And so I think that there's a lot of questions of where do we go from here. But the first is to make sure that we have people to take care of the people that we love and care for, because they can't come for all of us. So that's really the first thing, is do we have structures in place to take care of each other?
Because you wrote something in a Guardian article immediately after Charlottesville, which I thought was kind of amazing, really. You said, I know some of those students. They were ready to die for what they believed in. I was prepared to die too. That's a pretty crazy realization to have about anything, I think. I mean, I've never had that realization about anything. Like, how do you go back after that?
I don't think you do. I don't think you do. I can't. There is no going back for me. There's only going forward. There's only going through. What happened on the 11th and the 12th is irreparable. I will never be the person that I was on August 10th ever again. And it's frustrating because it's not like we didn't see this coming. I spent 2 months. I worked harder on this than anything else in my life, trying to get this event shut down, trying to raise the alarms, trying to get the city to do something to prevent this from happening. And it happened. And now everyone is saying, oh, we're so shocked that this happened. And so where do we, you know, I don't know how to go from here other than we have to just keep fighting and prevent the next one and prevent the one after that. And hopefully we get enough people that we don't have to have that ever happen again. It was really heartwarming to see the next weekend in Boston, there was another rally planned. Not the same people, but a lot of overlap. And 100 people showed up for the right, and 40,000 people showed up to counter-protest that. And that's the equivalent of one person counter-protesting for every resident of the city of Charlottesville. Came out. So if we can keep that momentum going, if that's what we can build towards, then we actually have a chance to get through this.
And Matt, what about you for the next, let's say, 3 years?
Well, you know, I'm a champion for the rights of marginalized communities. Marginalized people we don't want to be activists. We don't want to have to do this, but we have no choice. It's self-defense, you know? Like, we have to act because we're being hurt. What I see is these Trump administration, these things are no longer affecting marginalized people. Now it's spreading into the general populace, you know? The government, United States, like, you know, the Constitution begins with we the people. But now our government doesn't represent the thoughts, feelings, cares, and dreams of the average person. So I think it's, you know, I have to agree with Emily. It's going to get darker. It's going to get harder. It's going to hurt more people, people they care about. It's going to directly affect us all, from our health, the air we breathe, the body that we're in, to like the cities that we have and how we interact with it. And technology is going to be used against us, and we have to find a way to use technology to save us.
And for someone listening in the UK right now, wondering what they can do or sure. how they can respond to the situation which they recognize in a different context, say, what would your advice be?
Be suspicious of things, you know, be critical of things, like Schedule 7, right? Seems like it's against terror, you know, seems like we should have these extra, you know, implementations and laws, but you can be taken from like getting off of a plane, ushered into a room, questioned without any kind of legal support, your family doesn't know where you are, held for a very long period of time, you know? What good does this really bring? Does this make our lives better? Does it make the people we care about safer? You know, adding more cameras, adding more technology, these things can't be taken back. So we owe it upon ourselves to be critical. There's this exhibit in London called the Glass Room. Check out things like that, you know? Let you kind of realize, like double think about technology. There's a double edge to all tech. You know the great part that you're using, but think about the other part, the part that's under the iceberg, that's under the water.
What's at the classroom?
The classroom is an exhibit that shows how surveillance and a lot of different tech can be used against us. They have interesting exhibits there. You know, they, for example, one is a computer chip that was developed with support of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that implanted in a woman can affect her fertility. Like, why would we need that, you know? And things like that, a map of all the companies that Google acquires from in industries that you would never think, why would Google be interested there? So, but it's really just like a pop-up store. It's like a tech store, you know, like your Apple store or your tech giant, you know, like Saturn or something. But it shows you the other side of tech. And, you know, see how you feel. Go and check it out. That's what I recommend to people. Things like that can help you. And go to your local crypto party. CryptoParty.in is a website, and you can find people who can answer questions for you and talk more about this stuff.
Great. Well, thank you both so much for coming on. Best of luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll be back in 2 weeks with another Upvote. In the meantime, that's all from us.